Welcome to Crossing the Divide, the official podcast, a grassroots multimedia exploration of the intricacy of life in the Intermountain West. Crossing the Divide elevates local voices to educate the community on regional matters and fosters cooperative engagement in overcoming the unique challenges of life west of the Continental Divide. Not New York, not LA. Crossing the Divide is a unique tribute to life in the continental in-between. I'm Gretchen Reist, your guide over the divide and into the diverse terrain of Western Colorado. In this edition of Crossing the Divide's official podcast, we'll visit with Heidi Dragoo, Epidemiology Program Manager at Mesa County Public Health. We'll take an in-depth look at the dreaded cold and flu season and hear the latest on the mysterious uptick in cases of AFM, a polio-like illness afflicting young people in at least 22 states across the country. We'll end the show with helpful advice on keeping healthy through the hectic holiday season. So Heidi, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Gretchen.
My first question for you, as the Epidemiology Program Manager at Mesa County Public Health, what is epidemiology and what does an epidemiologist do?
Great question, and one that I get all the time, both from colleagues, family members. So epidemiology is really the science behind public health. So that means that epidemiologists are really the disease detectives. We're the ones who investigate and study the causes of illness, injury, and death among our residents here in the county. That's everything from the flu to scary things that we hope we never see here, like Ebola. For listeners that might not know, there's a pretty big outbreak right now happening in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And you might wonder, well, what does that have to do with Mesa County? Well, it's in a part of the world that's really unstable. And so a lot of the medical workers over there and the public health officials, they're actually not able to get to the epicenter of the outbreak to do things like find the people who are sick or find the people who were in contact with them. And you can imagine, things can spread a lot quicker that way if you're not able to stop things right in their tracks. So it's something that I know my team here is monitoring closely, especially because it's very close to a kind of an important center of trade, and all it takes is a plane ride, a boat ride, somebody going wherever, and you know, you've got a bigger challenge. So we definitely, believe it or not, here locally, we do track those things and are paying attention to things happening internationally because we do have our airport here. So it's just a quick flight away. And then things that are kind of weird, like rabies and rabies in animals, also rabies in people. The cool thing about Mesa County and Grand Junction is we actually have this awesome urban center, if you will, of Grand Junction, but we also have a lot of rural areas. And with that, it becomes a really fun place to study disease because we get the urban big city diseases, but we also get all the rural stuff like hantavirus, you know, which is carried by mice, tularemia, which prairie dogs are really susceptible to, plague. It's a fascinating place to study diseases. To an extent, with some of the diseases, we actually do this regionally. So we also provide services to 15 other counties in Western Colorado.
Let's start with the basics. So if you can, in layman's terms, what exactly is a virus?
The important thing, and I think what's really important for listeners to know the difference between a virus and a bacteria is, you know, bacteria are typically treated with antibiotics. That's kind of their hallmark, if you will. Viruses are not treatable with antibiotics. And that's really important as we get into our discussion about cold and flu season. Really important to know that those aren't treated with any kind of antibiotic. Sometimes the secondary infections might be, but viruses in and of themselves are typically not treatable, with any of those antibiotics. They do make things called antivirals that can help lessen the severity of viruses. The other kind of important hallmark of viruses is that they are able to change. And that becomes really important when we talk about flu. And that's why getting a perfect match between a flu strain and a flu vaccine is so difficult, because the flu is a virus and it's constantly evolving. So as it encounters new hosts, new environments, it actually has the ability to evolve and to change small, very, very small details about its viral structure, But those little changes can make, for example, coming up with a vaccine really, really challenging.
I am a self-certified germaphobe. So I have a rule at my house about sharing food. I don't like to do it. I don't like my kids to do it. And I will usually get the looks of, "Mom, I feel fine." At what point after someone has become exposed to a virus, say, at what point in the course of an illness is a person the most contagious? And does that depend on the infection?
Yeah, so there's not one kind of gold standard for all viruses. So if we take flu, for example, because we're in flu season, typically with flu, you know, it's a very infectious virus. It's not as infectious as norovirus, but it's certainly infectious. So let's say you are exposed to flu. It's going to take a couple of days, usually about 2 to 3 days, for you to what's called incubate. That means the virus is getting into your system. It's starting to take over. And with flu, you can actually be infectious from 1 day before your symptoms show up to 5 days after. And that's just kind of the average. So if you are someone who, let's say, is an older adult over the age of 65, or you are immune compromised, so you have some kind of underlying medical condition, you might shed that virus for much longer. But typically, to answer your question, the time where you're most infectious is going to be at the very beginning for flu, the very beginning of that illness. So the first couple of days, you have the highest viral load, your body's trying to respond and kind of ward off this incoming invader. But yeah, typically those first couple of days in the illness, you're very infectious. So if your kiddo at home has flu or is starting to feel sick with fever and a cough, maybe some sore throat, I would not recommend sharing that food.
So we're talking a little bit about hosts. What about this concept of a carrier? Now, I first heard about carriers through the very famous one, Typhoid Mary, who I believe was a waitress somewhere and who was a carrier of typhoid fever, but did not actually come down with the illness herself. Is that something that is rare, or do we have carriers all around us who can be carrying more, let's say, innocuous type illnesses that they could be contagious, but not actually ever become ill themselves?
I think it's a lot more common than I want to believe. I think the carrier status, absolutely, and again, kind of depends on the particular germ that you're talking about. But yes, it is out there. It's real. And you can be carrying a lot of different things. So we know, for example, that if we were to sample, let's say, 100 healthy adults, let's say sample kind of what's in our nose and throats, there are probably many of us that are carriers of a whole bunch of things, but aren't actually showing any symptoms of that. So that's why, and as an epidemiologist, I'll say one of our most important messages is just really good disease prevention in everyday life. So that is why things like hand washing with soap and water, covering your cough, covering your sneeze, you know, coughing or sneezing into the elbow, that's kind of a great one. That's why those messages are so important, because for all of the diseases that we know about when we see somebody sick, there are so many more germs that are out there that we're exposed to constantly that we don't see, or we're not seeing any manifestation of.
One thing that I think many of us notice is that it often seems that no two people might react exactly the same to the same virus. What is the reason for that? Why would somebody get the flu and get hit really hard and maybe get a secondary infection, whereas somebody else would get sick but not quite so bad?
There's a couple of different factors that go into that. You know, certainly for as many people as we have, you know, here on planet Earth, there's just as many immune systems, right? So our body's ability to kind of fight off and ward infection. Another kind of factor that plays in is kind of what is your medical status at the time of that infection, right? So are you healthy? Are you, let's say, you know, undergoing cancer treatment? Do you have a lot of kind of comorbidities? And when I say that, I mean like other health conditions. Are you at kind of a different phase of life. So again, are you like a young child under the age of 5? Are you a brand new baby that still has, you know, mom's antibodies to a certain extent? Are you a pregnant woman? Are you, you know, an older adult? So kind of where you are in your life course, I think also very much plays a role. So those are kind of two things that maybe are, at least the first one, modifiable to an extent, but you know, we are where we are in life. One thing that does make a difference for some of these pathogens, some of these germs, are vaccines. And so with flu, for example, you know, getting a flu shot is really the best protection that we all have as people to prevent severe complications from the flu. That's really important to know that the flu vaccine, it may not prevent you from getting the flu. The reason for that is when scientists have to make the decision about flu vaccine, sometimes 6 to 12 months ahead of flu season, they're taking their best guess. So they're using data from what's happening in the southern part of the world, the southern hemisphere. They're using what they know about strains that circulated in previous seasons. But at the end of the day, it's an educated guess. And sometimes they get it really right and sometimes not so right. And there's a lot of work being done in the, I would say in the medical community to improve how vaccines are developed and to make that more timely. Certainly that's what all of, you know, at least me as a public health official that I really am optimistic for in the future is that we have a more timely, you know, vaccine development cycle, especially for flu. So even in years, however, where it's not a great match, the vaccine is still really great at preventing those severe complications. And that's really important. I try to stress that every time I can when I'm talking with people in the community that it may not prevent you from getting the flu, but it's definitely going to keep you out of the hospital and prevent you from dying from the flu.
You talked about the ability of a virus to evolve. I assume that's why we have a new flu vaccine every season. What about those viruses that are preventable through a series of vaccines that you go through for a certain period of your life and then you're considered to be immune from? What is the difference between, let's say, the measles and the flu? Why don't you have to get a measles vaccine all the time? Why aren't they evolving like that?
So I'm definitely not an immunologist, but I will do my very best to answer that question. So my understanding is that just as there are, you know, many varieties of viruses, their viral structure is very different. So with flu, and I guess flu is kind of the best example. With flu, there's something about flu's viral structure that's able to adapt and change, especially as it moves through different hosts. So flu can impact not only humans, but it can impact birds, it can impact pigs, a lot of other wild animals. And so as it moves through those different hosts, it actually evolves that way. So the fact that it's able to cross the species barrier, if you will, that allows it to adapt. Whereas measles, you know, humans are the only kind of true host of measles, right? So measles is not going to impact a pig or, you know, a bird. So there's no mutation happening through those jumps, if you will. So that is my understanding of why we're able to have one vaccine or one series of vaccines, let's say for like measles, mumps, and rubella, as opposed to one every single year for flu. You know, scientists are really working hard to try to crack flu to figure out, okay, if we know it shifts, if it changes, what can we do to get ahead of that? And that's a tremendous challenge. It really is, because it's constantly evolving. And that's why, at least folks on the public health side, we pay attention when there are stories. You know, you'll hear stories in the news about that novel flu strain somewhere in Southeast Asia in a remote location. We pay attention because those things are a really big deal if they jump into the human population.
While we're on the subject of vaccinations, the last few years, I think a lot of parents have been leery of getting their children vaccinated. How are we doing here in Mesa County in terms of vaccinations compared to the rest of the nation?
We have a long way to go. So I'm just looking here at our flu vaccine numbers that we have. So last flu season, adults in Mesa County had about a 40% coverage rate in flu vaccine. And we know that that's probably, that would be an overestimate probably for other routine immunizations. So we know that we have a long way to go for immunizations. I hear a lot from parents in the county related to the concern for childhood immunizations, with the biggest concern being really the number of vaccines. You know, they're taking their child into the doctor's office and they're seeing their child get poked like six or seven times. And that's a lot. And I absolutely, you know, understand that concern. And I think my constant message is, before any of these vaccine schedules are even put out, they're put through rigorous testing. There's a lot of science behind that. It's not just folks sitting around the table saying, Gretchen, today we're going to decide that you need seven MMRs. So I would encourage our community to remember that there's a lot of really good science that goes into figuring out those schedules. And it's not, you know, to make your child feel horrible in the doctor's office getting seven pokes, but there is actually good hard science behind why those series happen when they do.
So if we look at a population where there could be a potential low vaccination rate, who is most at risk? So if I have been vaccinated, my children have been vaccinated, is there any risk to us when you have a larger than desirable percentage of the surrounding population that has not been vaccinated? Or is it simply a danger to all of those who haven't been?
Right. So that's definitely a great question. In the public health world, we call that herd immunity, right? So it's, if we think about the superhero in all of us when we've been vaccinated, right? You're up to date, you've gotten your shots, you're protected. So for example, in the case of measles, you know, if we look at some of these different diseases for which we have vaccines for, and measles is a great example, they all have different levels of what we consider to be herd immunity. So if out of 100 people, if over 90 of them are immunized, it's going to protect those in the community who aren't immunized or aren't able to be immunized. So we absolutely recognize that there are lots of good reasons why somebody might not be able to get a vaccine. There might be a medical reason, religious reason. Those are very, very important things to consider. So really the benefit, as you mentioned, related to your question, so if you and your kiddos are immunized, the benefit is actually greater than the risk in that situation. So the benefit that you're providing to people around you and to protect those who can't be immunized is so powerful. And think of that as like your own inner superhero power, that you're protecting, you know, those kiddos on cancer treatment, that, you know, anyone who's immune compromised has some kind of an allergy and can't be vaccinated. So those levels are actually very, very high. And one thing that we're seeing, one of the things that we track at Public Health is looking at what are those vaccination coverage levels at our schools and our childcare centers. And what's interesting is we do have pockets of our community where we're approaching those herd immunity thresholds. So where maybe it's dipped a little bit below, or it's kind of hovering right in that area. And public health pays attention when that happens, because that means once we've dropped below that protection level, if you get that disease in that environment, it's going to spread like wildfire. And so there is a lot of importance to that, I guess, to that concept of herd immunity, that it really is, what is that level of protection that you need to protect everyone in that setting? So I think that's an important concept for folks to be aware of, that when you get a shot, you know, a vaccine, it's not just about you. It's also about our community. You know, think about your work environment. Think about, you know, if you have children at their childcare or their school, if you're an older adult, think about, you know, your friends that you have, or if you're in any kind of a congregate setting, you know, a long-term care facility, you're keeping all of those people safe with that decision. Only one other thing to add related to the flu vaccine. So I mentioned that, you know, when we look at adults in Mesa County, last year, it was about 4 in 10 had reported getting that seasonal flu vaccine. CDC sets a goal, kind of what they see as the best practice, and it's 70%. So we have a long way to go, and we're really working hard this flu season to get the word out, to make flu vaccine more accessible. You know, we know now that our community is getting their flu vaccine in a lot of different places. It's widely accessible at pharmacies, at, you know, regular providers' offices. A lot of businesses are offering vaccines as well. We have our public health clinic at 510 29 and a half Road in Grand Junction, and folks can come in, get their flu vaccine. We really encourage everyone to get a flu shot this year. It's really, really important. We in Mesa County had a very severe flu season last year. It was our worst on record. And we started tracking, I believe back in, it was the 2004-2005 flu season. So the worst season since then, even worse than our 2009-2010 year, which when I bring that up in conversation, it surprises folks. They think, oh, it was the pandemic. It couldn't have been worse. And it actually was a lot worse. We had 232 people who were hospitalized for flu in the county. That's crazy. That's a lot of people. And so, you know, bearing in mind our recent experience of flu in this community last year, we really want to be vigilant and make flu vaccine accessible for those who want it.
When you talk about death from flu or hospitalization, is it the actual flu itself, or is it more often a result of those secondary infections?
So when I talk about flu hospitalizations, it's flu that put the folks in the hospital. When we talk about flu deaths, it gets a little bit tricky, kind of based on how death tracking is done through kind of our vital records system. Oftentimes with flu as a cause of death, flu will kind of be the straw that broke the camel's back, if you will, that it's kind of just the thing that sets someone over. So oftentimes it's in the setting of multiple underlying conditions. It's, you know, the folks had kind of larger issues happening. But in some cases, you'll hear of a perfectly healthy person who came down with the flu and died. So that happens as well. I was just reading, there was, I think it was the first flu death this season in the United States. I think it was in Florida. And it was a similar story. It was kind of a young, healthy person. And, you know, a couple days later, they've died. And that's scary. And I think that's one thing, if you were to ask me what keeps me up at night disease-wise, it's flu. It's pandemic flu. Knowing that we have something that can affect a population so aggressively and so fast and can strike down, you know, the young and healthy, that's what keeps me up at night.
And it's interesting. I wonder if sometimes people don't put as much emphasis on getting that flu shot because it's something we see regularly. Every year it comes around. And so people think, well, it's so common. It's like the cold. It's not like measles or things that you see pop up very rarely. When in fact, my understanding is the flu is one of the biggest threats to human health.
It is. And it's one of the biggest killers too. I mean, you're absolutely right. For some reason, you know, flu isn't quite as, I don't know, exciting maybe as measles or, I mean, even Ebola, right? I mean, when one case of Ebola pops up, it's a huge deal. When we have 232 flu hospitalizations in a season, okay. And although on the public health side, we were absolutely geared up with our medical partners, we were ready to go, monitoring things like hospital bed availability, it's just not as exciting. But I think the fact that flu has the ability to change so rapidly really is something that we should all be paying attention to, and definitely is something that I know my team pays attention to, because all it takes is a little bit of that change and it's a whole new threat.
It's interesting too that you mentioned employers offering flu shots. We don't think about the economic impact of the flu, lost time at work.
We did some estimates with our flu report last year, just looking at, you know, the cost. It's the comparison of how many immunizations to a hospitalization. And the number was huge. I'm not recalling it right off the top of my head, but it was, you know, you could get a lot of flu vaccines for the cost of one hospitalization. And you're right. I mean, considering those factors like, you know, if you get sick as an adult, right, and you have to miss work, but then think about the ripple effects of that. You know, if you have a family, you know, you may not be able to take your kids to childcare or school, or you might not want them at home if you're infectious. So like, what are you doing about that? Or if your kiddo gets sick, you know, are they exposing the rest of the classroom? There's a lot of, kind of ripple effect from that and a lot of economic impact. The lost, I think, time at work is a really, really big one and something that's a challenge. You know, we have a lot of employers that might not necessarily have paid sick leave. So there's also that challenge. And I know that even at Public Health, where you would think we would be excellent about staying at home when we're sick, not always the case. And sometimes, you know, you have to say, look, I'm really not feeling well. It's not only good for me to recover, but I need to not share this with all my coworkers as well. So that is a challenge that we run into a lot where folks think, okay, I have to go into work. But I would just encourage you, you know, if you're really feeling sick, the best thing you can do is just stay home and rest. Try to stay hydrated, especially with flu. Monitor the fever. You need to not be at work, not at school, not at childcare, definitely not visiting any new babies during that time. But that really is the best medicine. You know, in the absence of having a great treatment for flu, the best thing you can do is just take that time to rest and recover at home.
Now, what about some of the antivirals? I think there's a Tamiflu. I think I read an article just recently where the FDA maybe approved an additional. Is that something that you recommend? Does it actually work? Let's say you come down with the flu. Do you recommend get to the doctor and get on a prescription for one of these?
I'm a little bit old school in my train of thinking. Because flu, you know, has such a sudden onset and you're feeling so miserable, oftentimes a lot of people will not seek medical attention right away. They'll say, oh, no problem. I'm going to kind of manage it at home, self-soothe, see what happens. And then usually 2 to 3 days in, then they're feeling still kind of bad. And they're like, yeah, maybe if I have my healthcare provider, I'll call them. At that point, the antivirals don't work. So that's the trick. You know, the studies that have been done on flu antivirals, they are shown to be most effective the sooner that you administer them or that you take them. So usually within 24 hours of illness onset. So even at that, they've been found to be minimally effective as far as reducing the length of time that you're sick. It might be a great choice for someone in a high-risk population. So if you're an older adult really at greater risk of being hospitalized or dying from the flu, definitely a good consideration to talk with your doctor about. But for kind of the young, healthy adult, if it's taken us 2 to 3 days to even get in to talk to our provider, if they even want to see us, at that point, it's not going to make a huge difference. You've already, you know, been really infectious for that time. You're already on your way to recovery at that point. So definitely something, if you catch it early, you should talk to your doctor about, especially if you're in that high risk population. However, if you're like most of us and you're not going to seek that treatment until later, it's not super helpful, unfortunately. The only other thing to mention about flu is this year is the 100-year anniversary of the 1918 Spanish flu. And I will just note that as being important for a couple of reasons. The first being that the Spanish flu was really kind of the first time that pandemic flu was really well-documented, I'll say, kind of in the world. It struck down the young, healthy adults, kind of the 18 to 30-year-olds, the people who should be the strong-bodied, able-bodied, you know, strong immune system folks. And so it's a great example of just how dangerous flu can be. And that 1918 flu strain was actually an H1N1 virus, which is also important to know. The flu strain that we saw last year predominantly in Mesa County was an H3N2. They all have these really complicated names, but just knowing that 1918 flu was a really big deal because it killed off a lot of the young, healthy people. The other kind of interesting piece is that it's thought there's a lot of conflicting thoughts on this, but one thought is that the 1918 Spanish flu actually started in Kansas at Camp Funston with at the military outlet there. And so not too far away from wonderful Colorado, where these sometimes global things can actually get started. So it's sort of a neat kind of local connection there. And it really, not surprisingly, because it struck sort of the young, healthy, able-bodied folks, it just wiped out a lot of our military bases here in the United States at the time, just totally wiped them out. And there are many stories from many cities across the U.S. where their military bases are just, they're all under quarantine. There's the story of I think he was a congressman or a senator at the time, who went into one of the army barracks, I think it was on the East Coast, while they were under quarantine, and he actually got the flu and died because he was like, nope, I'm just going to go in and visit with them, and not listening to, hey, they have a flu outbreak. So, but no, that's all to mention about flu.
We'll move on to one that we're hearing a lot in the news lately, and that's called AFM. So first off, what is AFM?
So AFM is an acronym for acute flaccid myelitis, and it's basically a clinical syndrome. So it's not really anything, I will say it's different than a lot of the diseases that public health tracks, for example, like salmonella, where you give a stool sample and there's a positive for salmonella. So with AFM, there's not one test for it. You look for a series of symptoms. So things like paralysis, that's kind of the hallmark symptom. It is, it's been all over the news lately. There have been cases across the U.S. Here in Colorado, we haven't seen any cases in Mesa County. There have been cases, I believe, on the Front Range, but we haven't seen any here in our county. We do have great systems in place for when we do have a case. So typically what will happen is the provider will see the patient, they'll make that diagnosis, and they call public health. One of the things that has been reported, at least in some news stories, is that it appears to be due to this mystery illness. And that hasn't been our experience in Colorado. From the last information I heard, really our cases here were due to enterovirus, I believe is the causative agent. And so that's really important for listeners to know, that the cases that have been seen here in the state do have a cause. And enterovirus is a big family of viruses. There are a lot of different strains. I think that is important, that it's not something that's mystery or unknown, but that we do have kind of a causal virus associated with it. It's been in and out, I would say. It seems like every couple of years we hear about it again, although it seems like it's a different strain every time. So that's, yeah, it's of interest that I think the last time I heard about it, it was the D68, and then it was the A71, and there's so many strains of enterovirus. But again, I think what's important for listeners to know is what prevents the spread, not only of enterovirus, but a lot of other things, are those really good disease prevention measures. So those are things like we talked about, hand washing with soap and water, you know, avoiding contact with people who are sick. You know, if you are sick, staying home. It's kind of this, it actually goes back even 100 years to the 1918 pandemic flu. Many of the measures that communities were implementing are a lot of the measures that we still use today. So things like they had to close down some of the saloons. And although we might not have saloons, you know, if things got really bad, we might have to close down public places, right? Things like shopping centers or schools. But more realistically, things like social distancing, right? So if I'm sick, not going to my friend's birthday party or going to a huge parade, like staying home and keeping my germs to myself. So that's really cool. And I'm kind of a big history buff, but it's neat that many of the measures that we used, that public health used back in 1918, are still, they might look a little different, but still the same in concept. So I think that's really great. But yeah, I mean, enterovirus, norovirus, flu, you know, how do you prevent those? Like we talked about, hand washing with soap and water, staying home when you're sick, avoiding contact with sick people, getting your vaccine if it's a disease for which there is one. So with flu, it's one of the best ways that you can keep yourself protected. And then making sure that you're also having those conversations with your loved ones. So, you know, I've been asking all my family members, hey, have you guys gotten your flu shot? You know, and really kind of, I would say I'm badgering them, which is fine. I'm a public health person, so I can. Our recommendation at Public Health is that folks receive their flu vaccine by the beginning of November. What that does is it allows the 2 weeks for the vaccine to provide full protection, and then that way you're good going into travel season, holiday season, family season, large gatherings. These bugs, so norovirus and even flu, you know, although we consider flu season from October until about May, flu's always around. Flu's there in the summer. You know, as we get into these colder months, people come inside, right? We're not spending nearly as much time outdoors. Well, unless you're, you know, doing all your fun outdoor sports. But for the most part, we're spending a lot more time inside in close quarters with others. And I think those viruses are able to just transmit more efficiently. They really are. You know, if you've got a whole group of people together in a close setting and somebody sneezes, awesome. If I were a flu virus, that would be how I would get around. So yeah, I think it's exactly that. They just have a more efficient way to get around that time of year. And that's especially for norovirus. I mean, when we've got the windows closed, everybody's inside. We have an intern right now in our program, and some work that she had to do for a microbiology class at CMU, they had to swab kind of common things around them. And she had to swab the bottom of her shoes. And she found E. coli and a Staph aureus there. And her shoes looked perfectly clean. So it's not like there was debris there. So the takeaway is that germs are always around us. And, you know, although many of them are great, there are a lot of really good germs that help us do awesome things. We also have some germs that can make us sick. So kind of those good disease prevention messages to keep you healthy, you know, through the flu and norovirus November.
Is there anything else you'd like to leave us with?
Well, Gretchen, I appreciate the opportunity to be here with you talking about all these wonderful diseases that make me so happy. I think the biggest takeaway that I'll leave listeners with is that public health is all about prevention. And so, you know, our ultimate goal with tracking these diseases is to stop the spread early and to keep our community healthy. And I think it's just important to know that, you know, here in Mesa County, we have a whole team of disease detectives who are monitoring 24/7 for these pathogens of concern. So rest well at night knowing that you have a team of disease detectives behind this community that are watching those things like Ebola in the Congo and what flu is doing in Australia to be ahead of the curve for when these things hit Mesa County.
That ends another edition of Crossing the Divide. Thanks for tuning in. Follow us on Facebook and now on Instagram at Crossing the Divide to keep up on latest releases and other events. Crossing the Divide, cultivating community through conversation.